normally at this time, it'd be time for kids third grade and under to head back to Children's Church. However, we are a bit short-staffed today, so little kids are going to stay in here with us today. We do, however, have nursery, though, so really little kids are still welcome to head off to nursery if they would like. Yeah, hopefully next week we'll have Children's Church running again. Origin stories are important. Think about the amount of just like cultural freight right now that is weighing on whether you think that the origin or the founding date of our country was 1776 or 1619. Or to take a slightly less on-the-nose example, think about how much of your family's history and wrapped up in stories like how you met your spouse or how your parents got married. Origin stories tell us a lot about ourselves. They don't just tell us, you know, where we came from, but also they say something about our values as a community. They tell us, often even they give us a picture of where we hope to go in life. And this morning we're going to be looking at one origin story in particular, the origin story of ancient Israel. And we're going to be looking at how they told that story through something called the Passover Festival. And we're looking at the Passover as actually part of a larger series on the topic of rest. And so it may, on the face of it, seem kind of an odd thing to draw a connection between rest and the Passover. But the way that we're going to be doing that, the logic goes kind of like this. So most of us are pretty exhausted these days, and most people that I know are generally pretty weary and worn out, in need of a good rest at the moment. And most of the things that we're turning to for rest these days aren't actually delivering on their promise. I mean, you can spend all weekend scrolling through Instagram, watching everything that's available on Netflix, reading every book, going for every hike, and then get to Monday morning still feeling just as exhausted as you were on Friday afternoon. And that's if you get a weekend off. Because, of course, a lot of us, for any kind of stay-at-home parent or somebody who's primarily a caregiver for somebody that they love, they probably aren't getting weekends off. And so what are we to do? Where do we find rest that doesn't just give us a break from work, but actually a rest that goes down into our souls and transforms us? Fortunately for us, God gave us an entire calendar of rest. He gave us not just the Sabbath day every week, though that by itself would be fantastic, but an entire calendar of feasts and festivals that were intended to teach his people over time how to rest. And they were intended to give them rest that wasn't just like the physical rest of taking a day off of work, but rest that transformed them as people and as a community. And so as we look at the different parts of this calendar, the point of looking at them isn't to simply to say, okay, well, God told them to take a week off every spring, and so maybe we should do something exactly like that too, although that might not be a bad idea or a bad application, really, but to actually look at them and ask, what was this meant to convey to them? What was this meant to teach them about God and their relationship to him? How is it intended to shape them as a community? And along with that, how do they tend to mess it up? And how do we tend to mess it up? How do we tend to turn from rest in God to restlessness? But then finally asking, how do both of those things ultimately point us to Jesus as the true and satisfying rest that we're all looking for? And so last week, you may have remembered, we looked at the Sabbath day and how it was not just a rule to follow, but actually a means of God teaching his people that they are not just cogs in a machine, but beloved children made in his image. And so today, we're going to look at the Passover through that lens, what it was intended to teach us about rest. And so if you've got a Bible with you, I'd invite you to open with me to Leviticus 23, verses 4 through 8. It's also printed in your bulletins. There are a number of places in the Old Testament that speak about the Passover, but Leviticus 23, it's probably one of the most condensed places. And so we're going to start there, we're going to bounce all around, but that's going to be kind of our home base for looking at Passover. Leviticus 23, verses 4 through 8. It says this: "These are the appointed feasts of the Lord, the holy convocations which you shall proclaim at the time appointed for them. In the first month, on the 14th day of the month at twilight, is the Lord's Passover. And on the 15th day of the same month is the feast of unleavened bread to the Lord. For 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall have a holy convocation. You shall not do any ordinary work, but you shall present a food offering to the Lord for 7 days. On the 7th day is a holy convocation. You shall not do any ordinary work." This, brothers and sisters, is God's word. And so, like I mentioned, the point of looking at Passover isn't to figure out exactly how can we, you know, replicate this down to the every last detail, but to look at it and to ask first and foremost, what was this meant to teach God's people? What was this meant to convey to them about God and humanity and finding rest in Him? And so right away, we notice a couple of interesting things at the beginning. First off is that their calendar year began more or less with this festival. You notice how it says right at the beginning, in the first month on the 14th day, that this was essentially kind of their New Year's festival, right? Most people groups in the world celebrate some kind of New Year's celebration, often in the wintertime. But the Israelites, their calendar year started with the Passover in the spring. Why was that? Why did that have first and primary place in their calendar? Well, it's because the Passover was all about remembering the story of their exodus from Egypt. Every year, at the beginning of the new year, the Israelites were to start their year by remembering the story of God bringing their ancestors out of Egypt. And so in order to understand what Passover was all about, we have to go back to the story of Exodus and remember how that, what that was all about. And so the story of the Exodus, it goes something like this. God's people were in trouble. Centuries ago, their family had come to Egypt as refugees. And there was a great and terrible famine that stretched all throughout the Middle East, and the one place that was left that had grain to feed hungry bellies was in Egypt. Because God had already sent one of them ahead of their family. Years before the famine began, through an odd set of circumstances, God had sent one son, Joseph, to go ahead of his family there to make a place for them. God worked through this tragic set of circumstances that brought him there to actually, in the end, do good to his people, eventually working his way into the second highest position in the kingdom, second only to Pharaoh himself. And so when his family arrived as refugees, they received a warm welcome, like a family reunion, and they settled into the land. And for a few generations, it went well for them. They stayed, they put down roots, and they multiplied, and things seemed to be going just fine. Until a new Pharaoh came along. A Pharaoh who didn't remember anything about Joseph and what he'd done for the country, and who looked around and saw the Israelites, who by then had multiplied many times over, and saw two things in them. Number one, a threat, and number two, an opportunity. He saw a threat because on the one hand they were so numerous that if they ever rose up, they could probably overthrow the government. But number two, an opportunity. Because they were so numerous that they could easily translate into free labor. And so he decided to do what many despots over the years have done and enslaved them. And for many long years, for many long decades, God's people languished in slavery. And they cried out to him, God, why did you leave us here? What are you doing? Why did you allow this to happen? When will you come and rescue us, God? They cried out like that, and they cried out, and they cried out some more for years, for maybe even decades. We don't know how long. And all along, it seemed like God was silent. Until he wasn't. Because all those long years, God heard the cries of his people, and they stirred his heart, and he remembered his covenant that he had made with them. He remembered, and he decided to do possibly the most strange thing that he could do, which was to pick somebody who had zero qualifications to go and rescue them. Somebody who seemed to have thrown away every opportunity for leadership and influence that had been given to him. Somebody who had murdered somebody once upon a time and had to run away in order to face the stiff punishment of the law. And somebody who had actually like a physical speech impediment. Somebody who when he opened his mouth, words just would not tumble out the way that they do for most of us. And so when God said, I am raising you up, Moses, to send you back to your people, he said to God, thanks, but can you send my brother instead? And God just said to him, yeah, I'll send him too, but you're going as well. You're not getting out of this that easily. And so he sent both of them, Moses and Aaron, back to have a confrontation with Pharaoh for the ages. And 10 times they told Pharaoh, let my people go. And 10 times he resisted. And so each time that Pharaoh said no, God sent a plague on Egypt. And each plague, it had two main purposes. One was to carry out justice. The Egyptians had been carrying out a great injustice by enslaving the Israelites, and God hates injustice. His judgment may not come at a time or in a way that we might expect, but the truth is that nobody ultimately gets away with anything. And so God sent the plagues as judgment on the oppression and the sin of slavery. But there's a spiritual function to each of the plagues as well, which was that each of the plagues was meant to act as an unmasking of all of the gods of Egypt. It was meant to show that they were utterly powerless before the one true God. And God did this because idolatry is always wrapped up with injustice. Any time that you see an injustice taking place, there is always idolatry behind it. Any time that you see idolatry working, there is always an injustice that's going to work its way out of that. And so when God sees one, he judges both. And as God judged their injustice, he also judged their idolatry, showing how their sun god was powerless before the God of the universe, how their storm god could not hold back the hail, showing how their God of the harvest could not preserve their crops. But the last plague, the 10th, was set to be the worst of all. For the 10th and final plague, God was going to send an angel to kill every firstborn son in the country, all the way from Pharaoh at the very top down to the most lowly servant and slave family in the land, every single one of them. But to protect his people from that destroying angel, God sent an intercessor for his people. Someone to come between them and that angel meant to enact a terrible vengeance and justice. That intercessor was a Passover lamb. Each family in Israel was to sacrifice a lamb and to mark their doors with its blood. And when the angel saw that blood, it would pass over the house. It would not go in and harm anybody. And so Pharaoh woke up in the night, and his son, his oldest son, was dead, along with every other oldest son in Egypt. And so finally, at long last, he relented. And he sent the Israelites out of the country. after all those long years of oppression and slavery, after having their own sons killed by Pharaoh, finally they were free to leave. Finally they were set free to worship God and live in freedom. And so every year, at the start of the year, they were to remember this story. Every year, at the very beginning of their calendar, they were to stop and have a week-long festival to remember the price of their freedom from Egypt, to remember that they had been slaves in Egypt and that God had rescued them out of it, that he had delivered them. And so each year, at the beginning of the year, in spring, they would start their calendar by laying down their regular work for a week, make a pilgrimage all the way to Jerusalem from wherever they lived, and celebrate a Passover meal. And the meal involved several key elements, all of which were intended to remind them of their time in Egypt. They would eat these like bitter herbs that would remind them of the bitter labor that they had done as slaves in Egypt. They were to eat bread made without leaven, as we saw earlier in the Leviticus 23 passage. They were to eat bread made without yeast, to remind them of how quickly they had to get up in the middle of the night to flee from Egypt, so quickly that they didn't even have time to let their bread rise. And they were to eat a lamb that would remind them of their need for an intercessor, a lamb that would remind them of their need to have their own sins passed over by God, a lamb whose life was not spared so that their lives could be spared. And so when children asked their parents, why is it that we start our year this way? Why is it that year after year we walk all the way to Jerusalem to keep the Passover festival? Their parents were to tell them that we keep the Passover in order to remember. In order to remember our deliverance. We keep it to remember that we were utterly powerless, unable to do anything to save ourselves. God rescued us. We do it to remember that when we were enslaved by the Egyptians, God came and gave us rest, delivering us from their hands. We do it in order to remember that when God judged the injustice and the idolatry of the Egyptians, he had to send an intercessor, someone to die on our behalf, so that he could pass over our homes and not judge the secret sins and idols and injustices of our hearts too. Passover was meant to remind God's people, to form them as a community in the shape of this story of deliverance. It was meant to remind them that even when God seemed silent, he was listening. That even when they waited years upon years, that God heard the cries of his people and he responded. It was meant to remind them, even when their lives were filled with injustice and oppression with no end in sight, that God made a way when there was no way. It was meant to remind them when God judged the sin of the Egyptians, they all needed an intercessor too. It was meant to remind them of their deliverance. And I think it's fair to say that most of us need a reminder of all those things too. I mean, for many of us, I think part of the weariness that a lot of us feel is the weariness that comes from feeling unheard by God. There's a certain kind of weariness that comes from praying over and over again the same things, asking God for deliverance and for rescue, and feeling like your prayers just kind of go up to the ceiling, hit the ceiling, and bounce right back down to you. There's a certain kind of weariness that comes for longing for nearness from God, and yet feeling like he's a million miles away. Likewise, I think there's a weariness that comes from seeing all of the injustice in the world and not really feeling like we can actually do anything about it. I mean, a few weeks ago, towards the start of the series, I mentioned that I think most of us probably have like a low-grade case of compassion fatigue right now. Compassion fatigue is when you care and you care and you care and nothing actually fills up your caring tank again until it runs out. After a couple of years now of pandemic, social unrest in our country and wars abroad. I think most of our carrying tanks are running pretty low right now. And so as we look around and see rampant injustice and feel within ourselves the inability to actually do much that's really meaningful to stop it, I think a lot of us can come away exhausted and wearied, like we've run out of tears. And on top of all that, I think most of us tend to carry around some amount of weight of our own inadequacies. Some amount of weight, knowing that we aren't good enough, that we don't measure up, that we have this sneaking sense that we will never be good enough in some way, never be strong enough, never measure up on some cosmic scale. That if we were placed on a cosmic scale, to some degree we would all be found wanting. There's a weight that settles onto your shoulders when you feel that way. And so I think we all need rest like the Passover. We all need to be reminded that even when it seems as if God is silent, that even when it seems as if our prayers just go up and hit the ceiling and come right back down to us, that He hears, that His heart is stirred by the prayers of His people. I think we all need to be reminded that even when we see nothing but injustice around us, that God is a God of justice, and that His justice may not come in a time or in a manner that we would expect, but that it does, in fact, come eventually. We all need the rest that comes not simply from a day off of work or a fun vacation, but of being reminded that God is a God of deliverance. We all need to be shaped by the story of the Passover. We all need the hope and the peace that comes from the story of Passover and what it says about God, what it has to teach us about Him and about our deliverance. No wonder that God put it at the very start of their calendar. And yet for all of the promise that Passover has to teach us rest and to give us rest, there's also a problem with it as well. Throughout the Old Testament, there's a number of places where it mentions the Israelites celebrating the Passover, and each time it kind of acts as a high watermark, and then the ocean recedes a little bit. And it's almost like they take one step forward and then they take two steps backwards. For example, in the book of Joshua, it mentions that they celebrated the Passover right after they entered the Promised Land, and there was this great and wonderful and joyous celebration. And then if you keep on reading, you find out that over the years, they would quickly forget God and go running after other gods and fill the land with the same injustice that they fled Egypt to escape. Generations later, kings like Hezekiah and Joshua would celebrate the Passover, and once again, it would be this high mark, this joyous celebration. And then you keep reading, and you see that these men were just as filled with pride and folly as the rest of us. Generations after that, a group of exiled Israelites come home from exile in Babylon, and one of the first things they do is they begin work on a new temple to replace the one that had been destroyed, and they celebrate the Passover to mark this new beginning in the land, and it's this wonderful occasion of joy until they finish the temple, and everybody who is old enough to remember the first one weeps at the sight of it because it is so small and unimpressive compared to the first one. Over and over again, they have these moments of joy celebrating the Passover, but then it's this joy that's mixed with bitterness and sorrow. Why is that? Why is it that even in the midst of having this yearly reminder of their deliverance, they so quickly forget? Well, it's because even though God had gotten their bodies out of Egypt, Egypt was still alive in their souls. We see this probably most clearly in what's a story that might be best termed like an anti-Passover. So a couple of months after the Israelites come out of Egypt, they're sitting at the base of Mount Sinai, and Moses goes up the mountains and receives the Ten Commandments from God. And while he's up there, everybody else gets a little bit antsy and a little bit nervous. He's been gone a while. And so they start to ask, is he ever coming back? And so they co-opt his brother Aaron into making a golden idol for them, a golden calf. And after he crafts it, it pops out of the fire, and he says, here, O Israel, are your gods who brought you out of Egypt. In other words, he took the same story, and he applied it to something else. He applied it to a golden calf, which in their culture was a symbol of strength, a symbol of power. And we may hear this story and think they were absolutely bonkers, right? These are people who literally, like a couple of months ago, had been rescued themselves out of Egypt. They were literally the generation who had been brought out of Egypt. And here they are, like constructing an idol out of gold. We can scoff at that, and yet we do the exact same thing in our own ways. It's meant not to be a story that causes us to laugh at the silly Israelites, but to expose the way that we all have a bit of Egypt living in our hearts. A calf was a symbol of strength, and when they got tired of waiting on God, they made for themselves an image of strength. And we all do the same thing in our own ways. Whenever we get tired, we surround ourselves with alternative sources of strength. When we get tired of waiting on God, we lean on the strength of our accomplishments, on the things that we have done, on our greatest hits, things that show that hopefully we are enough. Or maybe we rest on the strength of our bank accounts and our retirement accounts so that maybe if the economy really tanks, then we'll still have enough. Maybe we trust our moral or intellectual strength so that maybe we can be good enough or smart enough. And while each of those provides us with a measure of security, ultimately they leave us feeling restless and insecure. Because in the words of one famous billionaire, how much is enough? Just a little bit more. Which is why we all need the story of a second Passover. You see, one year, many, many centuries ago, God's people were once again getting ready to celebrate the Passover. And they were celebrating at a time when tensions were high. They had been promised that God would restore them, and yet the Romans were ruling over their land. God had promised that he would one day come back and dwell with his people, and yet it seemed like he was just as distant as ever. And so everybody was coming up with new solutions for how to balance God's promises of restoration and God's promises of freedom and the reality of being under the boot of Rome. And so some people wanted to prove that they were strong enough. They wanted to rely on the strength of overthrowing the Romans themselves. They wanted to turn to violence. Others turned to the strength of prosperity, becoming prosperous enough from the Romans that they'd be able to get by. Still others wanted to rely on their own moral strength so that God would see how good they were acting and rescue them. And into that mix stepped Jesus, preaching neither violence nor compromise nor self-reliance, but a humble and rested trust in God. He came not preaching strength, but weakness, that the way down is the way up, and recognizing one's limits so that you can place your trust in God instead. And crucially, he didn't just come to preach, but also ultimately to die. He came to die at the height of that year's Passover festival as the ultimate Passover lamb, so that anyone who trusts in him would be covered by his blood. Each of the gospel writers go to great pains to show that he didn't just come as a good moral teacher telling us a great way to live, but actually that he came with his eyes set on Jerusalem, that he came with his gaze set firmly on the Passover, driving towards his death on the cross. So that in a world filled with injustice, where each of us have a bit of blood on our hands in Egypt in our hearts, that he would come to die and to cleanse our hearts, to act as our true and better intercessor, standing between us and the wrath of God. He came to die as the ultimate Passover lamb, to cover our sins and to wipe Egypt out of our hearts. And he didn't just do that, but he also came to rise again from the dead. And by rising again from the dead, to kick off a new kingdom, a kingdom in which death does not have the final word, a kingdom in which no earthly kingdom can ultimately rival it, not the power of Rome or Egypt or anybody else who is in power, but one in which all authority in heaven and on earth is granted to him. And he invites each of us to find rest in that kingdom. He invites each of us to find rest in him, to find rest in him as the ultimate Passover lamb, to find rest in knowing that our hearts, if you are a follower of Jesus, if you have placed your trust in him, then your heart has been cleansed of Egypt. You may give it a visa from time to time to come and visit, but the foundational reality is that if you are a follower of Christ, if you have trusted in him, then your heart has been cleansed of Egypt. He invites us to step into the rest of his promised kingdom, to step into the rest of a kingdom that will fill the world one day as the waters cover the sea. He invites us to step into the rest, into resting in the knowledge that even though the world is now filled with violence and injustice, he is still a God of justice. He is still at work delivering people. One of the most interesting books that I've read recently is a book called Dominion by a guy named Tom Holland. He basically looks at the last 2,000 years of world history and traces out Christianity's impact on the world. And one of the things that he draws out is that our very concept of human rights, our very concept that people are created equal and that every person deserves freedom, that comes directly from the outgrowth of the Bible, out of the outgrowth of this vision of God's kingdom. And likewise, not only do all of these human rights movements that we've seen setting people free over the years have everything to pay back to this vision of God's kingdom, also there is coming a day when God will complete the project of his kingdom, when he will set every captive free. He invites us to rest in the future hope of the fulfillment of his kingdom. And so in order to remind us of this rest, he gave us something. Something to practice regularly, something that is meant to instill in us this message of rest. A humble and simple practice meant to remind us of our deliverance. Communion. The ultimate fulfillment of Passover is found in communion. On the night when he was betrayed, Jesus gathered around a Passover table with his disciples, and he lifted up that piece of unleavened bread, and he said, "This is my body, which was broken for you." Your whole life, you've heard the story of your ancestors coming out of Egypt, and I'm telling you that this actually, all of it was pointing forward to me, and how my body would be broken on your behalf. And he took the cup of wine, which was meant to remind them of the sacrificed lamb who died on their behalf, and he said, "This is my blood of the new covenant, which is poured out for the sins of many." Communion is a table that is meant to remind us of the true and greater Passover in Jesus. It's meant to remind us of his death on our behalf as our Passover lamb. The bread reminds us of his body broken for us. The juice or the wine reminds us of his blood shed for us. It reminds us of the rest that we can find in him. The rest that we can find from all of our attempts to justify us, all of our attempts to prove that we are enough. The rest that comes to us as we lay all of those down and find in him our enoughness. Find in him our true and better intercessor. It's a meal that's intended to remind us of his presence with us today. Historically, it was celebrated as like this entire full meal where we would sit down at a table, almost picturing us sitting down at a table with Jesus himself. And the bread and the wine, they may not be his literal body and blood, but they're meant to remind us that he is spiritually present with us, even when it feels like he isn't. And it's meant to remind us of his coming kingdom as well. When Jesus celebrated that final Passover with his disciples, he said that he wouldn't drink from the fruit of the vine again until he drank it anew in the kingdom. And that wasn't a promise of if, but when. Communion can act as a powerful reminder, not just of what Jesus has done for us, but also of what he is going to do. Of how there is a kingdom yet to come, a day when God will make all things new and all oppression shall cease. We can find rest in that too. Years ago, there was a time in my life where communion took on a special significance for me. I was working at that time two jobs trying to save up money for seminary. And since one was in a coffee shop and one was in retail, that meant that I spent all day, every day, on my feet. And during the holiday season, both of those jobs increased their hours until the point where I was spending for a couple weeks there about 60, 70, sometimes 80 hours a week, all of the time on my feet. And I quickly fell apart, became a wreck, physically and emotionally and mentally. But there's one thing that held me together in that season was the Eucharist, communion. There was something about the physicality of broken bread that reminded me that even when my body felt broken, Jesus' body had been broken for me. And that even at a time when I felt incredibly distant from God because literally all I was doing was working or sleeping, that he was near, that he was present. That even when it felt like my cries for rest were hitting the ceiling and bouncing back down, that he came to give me rest right in the midst of that exhaustion. It reminded me that even while he seemed far away, he was near. That bread and that juice, it reminded me of his lingering presence with us. So that even when I went back to work, each week I went back with a reminder. With a reminder of Jesus, the true and better Passover lamb. And so I think for the first time in my life, I finally got communion when that happened. I finally got the rest that it's intended to give us. It didn't mean that, you know, all of a sudden my bosses decided to give me a day off or something like that. But it meant that in the midst of exhaustion, in the midst of weariness and wondering how long I could continue that way, that God met me and he gave me rest. It was a reminder that he has delivered us, that he is delivering us, and that he will deliver us again. And so in just a moment, we're going to celebrate communion. Mark is going to lead us in communion in just a moment, and so let me close by praying for us. Jesus, we thank you for coming as our true and better Passover lamb. Lord, we all need the rest of having an intercessor. We all need the rest of knowing that you are near, and we all need the rest of knowing that one day you will make all things new and all oppression shall cease. So, Lord, give us that rest today and always. Lord, help us to draw near to you. Help us to cast our eyes on you when we feel exhausted, Lord, in a thousand different ways. Help us to remember you. We love you and we praise you, Lord.